You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me today is Phil Beatty, our Chief Knowledge Officer, and Tim Sawula, Head of Content and Engagement for the World Summit Series. Hi, guys.
Hi, Sarah.
Thanks for joining me today. We've got some great things planned for our World Academic Summit Series over the next few years. That's what we're talking about today. Tim, do you want to give us a bit more information about that?
Yeah, I mean, we are thrilled now that we're in a position. So the World Summit Series usually involves around sort of 8 or 9 summits over the course of the annual year, with the World Academic Summit always taking place in September. It's our flagship summit, and thematically it kind of underpins the conversations that we have around the world over the rest of the year. But now we're in a position, I'm delighted to say, that we've got the next 3 World Academic Summits confirmed for 2019, 2020 and 2021. So we are working with ETH Zurich this September 2019. We're working with the University of Toronto in 2020, and we'll be with NYU at their Manhattan campus in 2021. So it's a fantastic situation that we can now really work with our global community to kind of thread some of the big pictures together and tackle those over the course of the next 3 years.
Yeah, this is quite unique in what we've been trying to accomplish with our World Academic Summit Series, this real cohesive intellectual conversation over 3 years.
Yeah, I mean, we've run more than 25 summits since 2013, and bringing together around 6,000 people across the world. And it really does feel, and Tim's done some fantastic work to create what we think is really a global community. We're building long-term lasting networks and friendships across the world, across these summits. But I think what's really, really exciting is as we actually look forward and build a real sense of coherence to the series. So what we can do is make sure that each summit has a serious legacy. Each summit can inform the next summit, and we can ensure the content actually feeds through all the events, but also we can actually make sure that they're not just talking shops, that they do actually lead to outcomes, that there's a sense of accountability, that if we all come together, hundreds of university leaders with government figures and industry partners all come together for 2 or 3 days at the World Summit, is it just a talking shop? What do we actually deliver in terms of outcomes? What do we do in terms of getting people to go back to their institutions? What practices do they change? What learnings and lessons do they bring? And we can actually almost hold ourselves to account. So I love the fact that we're building this coherence between the years and across the whole series. It's really exciting.
And I think, I mean, it's important to point out for our listeners that the summits, we work with the host partners very closely. So it's a genuine partnership in terms of the way the programs are developed. Mm. And those host partners, the presidents, vice chancellors, they make it very clear at the outset that they only work with us on the basis that the summits are not a talking shop, as you described, Phil, and that, you know, that they have a genuine legacy that can be useful for you know, their peers, but also, you know, for the aspiring institutions, or, you know, the emerging talent, you know, early career researchers who observe and listen and contribute as well. So we've been working with the former ETH president Lino Gutzella, and now we're working with their new president Joël Meceau for the summit in 2019, which is all about the sort of the nature, the context, the location of talent. The title is called How Talent Thrives, and we're going to take that forward into 2020. We've also been, you know, working quite closely with Merit Gertler, and that's all around the power of place. You know, Gertler himself is an academic geographer. Toronto clearly, you know, making enormous progress in terms of establishing itself as a centre for, you know, AI research, biotech, you know, away from the US West Coast. And then for 2021, working with NYU, you know, that's going to all be around trajectory, you know, very much the trajectory of, you know, their students, the trajectory of the institution. You know, NYU in particular has had a remarkable transformation, you could describe it, since the 70s, you know, as it's evolved as a city, but then gone beyond the city limits and set up, you know, 15 or so campuses all around the world. Mm-hmm. So it really means that for everybody who comes to the summits over the next 3 years and all the summits in between, there'll be a real genuine thread that we hope will really empower and inform everybody who takes part.
I had a chance to speak to the presidents of all of our partner institutions for the next 3 years, and I asked them about this kind of foundational concept of talent. And then we talked a little bit more about what each individual institution was going to try to tackle at their summit. So the first president I spoke with was the former president of ETH Zurich, Lina Gazella, and this is what he had to say. As you know, we're going to be discussing talent at the summit in September at ETH Zurich. And I'd like to hear your thoughts about how you think this notion of talent has changed for the current generation compared to past generations of students.
You know, on the surface, you might think that this has changed. I mean, if you look at the kids today and you look, when I look back when I was in their age, completely different on the outside. I mean, they are digital natives, they are much more outgoing, they have seen more, they have done more probably also. But if you dig down a little bit deeper, really deeper, what the talent that we are looking for means, then I would say it's exactly the same. And the talent we are looking for are people who are able to analyze a situation, a given situation, to find rapidly the weak spots in this given situation, and then comes the most important step, to come up with a creative idea how to improve that. And that talent was the talent that was sought for 30 years ago, and this is the talent that we are still looking for today.
I get your point there, talking about being able to analyze a problem or being creative in finding a solution for a problem. But wouldn't you argue that there are some, maybe there are skills then, but definitely certain requirements that graduates today have compared to graduates 30 years ago?
They have another tool set available, or they have additional tool sets available, skills, as you told them. Absolutely agree with you. That's the more surface thing that I mentioned before. We didn't have access to that vast amount of data they have today. They are able to use this vast amount of data that they have today. So I believe that they will do a better job than we did. I agree with you. But the core job is still the same, and the ability to come up with new ideas, this is still something that is very much inherent to human brains, if I want to say that explicitly. And this is what we're looking for, these brains that are creative, you know, that are making unexpected moves, that are able to see what nobody else has seen before. Think of Einstein. I mean, this guy was sitting on, I don't know, 400 years of physics from Galilei to when he came, and he was able to see beyond these 400 years of development that had taken place so far. This is exactly the talent we are looking for, the ones who are able to find the unexpected.
Obviously, every student isn't going to be Einstein, but how would universities go about discovering that potential?
We wish, of course, everybody would be Einstein. That would be great. How do we discover that? I mean, it discovers itself. We, as university leaders, as faculty members, as people in the university on the senior side, we should create the conditions that these talents can flourish, that they can emerge. Of course, the problem is to select the right people. This is a very difficult task because it's not so easy to detect it. But once we have a group of young students in our houses, we should then create an environment that stimulates their curiosity, that endows them with the necessary facts. It's still important to understand what is going on so far. But those that gives them the room and the freedom to then explore their own ideas, to come up with their own failures. Via Data, we very much embrace the concept of constructive failure. So failing is an extremely important process, as long as you learn something from your failures, that helps you to really develop towards a direction where you come up with completely new ideas. So constructive failure is one of the ideas that we pursue. The other one is project-based learning, where we do allow students to really do things and to think them through completely from A to Z, to come up with solutions and then to have them tested even experimentally if it must be. So we need to provide the environment where then these talents can be developed.
Can you give me a concrete example of one way that ETH Zurich has done this beyond constructive failure and creating problems to find solutions? Are there any concrete examples that you can draw on?
Let's take ETH Week. We do every year before the semester starts, the fall semester starts, we do a one-week thing where students from all departments, I repeat, all departments, so from this ranges from social science and the humanities down to physics, come together. They work for 1 week on a challenge that is posed to them. Every year is a different challenge. Last year it was energy. Next year it will be mobility. And they look at that topic from an interdisciplinary point of view. And by doing that, teams of 20 students with very diverse backgrounds, diverse disciplines, diverse departments they are studying in, they interact and they do exactly what we discussed before. They try to analyze the problem, see where the weak spots are, and then come up with creative solutions. And by that, we help them to develop these skills, develop these talents that they have buried somewhere inside themselves. And we hope that this will bring bear fruit in the coming years.
And would you say that university is wasted on the young?
This is a very provocative statement. No, I wouldn't say that, of course. No way. I still believe that the idea of the universitas, the communion, the joint, close working together of students and educators, faculty members, is still one of the great ideas that humanity has come up with. And the young profit a lot, but also the older profit a lot. And coming together, it's for sure not wasting either one's time. No, this is one of the great ideas that humanity will continue to use to move forward.
I mean, clearly, though, lifelong learning is something that universities are starting to really focus on as they realize that their graduates become outskilled by the time they've been out of their institution for after 5 years or something, perhaps even sooner. So how would you say that lifelong learning fits into your idea of what you just described of young people coming together with old people and creating this learning environment? How does lifelong learning fit into that?
Lifelong learning is extremely important if you look at the tools that you use. They change rapidly, I agree with you. The ideas that around these tools, the skills, they change rapidly. And this is a task that everybody has to take up, stay abreast of these developments, keep up with the pace. And it's just part of the daily routine, like brushing your teeth. Once a day, you read something, you learn something on the internet, you take a MOOC, you take a short video sequence, and you try to keep up with the skill set. This is necessary, but not sufficient, once again. If you're just if you're just aware of the latest programming language, it doesn't make you a good programmer. You're just then somebody who is able to apply that. But if you want to be somebody who does not apply, but creates, and this is the objective of a true world-class universities is to create, to educate people who are able to create. This is something that you have to learn once, and once you have learned it in the sense that you have made confidence that you can do that, that you have really seen the basic concept, then you hone this ability, of course, by becoming better and better. But this is something that you need to have a first initial ignition at a place where you really can do that. And I believe, once again, that these are universities. Universities where people come together physically to work, learn, and produce these new ideas.
And that creativity that you're talking about, is that something that is inherent to students, like the talent that you were talking about earlier? Or is that creativity something that they can learn at universities?
You need the talent for that. Talent is the... If you look back, what does talent mean? Talent means that there is the ability to develop that feature, that ability. Then, of course, once you have this talent, you need to hone it, you need to develop it, you need to practice it. I mean, even if you are the most talented piano player, if you don't practice 6 hours a day, you will never reach the level that a global piano player achieves today, that is needed to be among the top piano players. So it is this combination of the possibility and then the hard working to make this possibility come a reality. This is probably the most important difference to what happened, how the situation was 30, 50 years or maybe 100 years ago. The pace of everything has dramatically increased. So So it's becoming more and more difficult to be up to date. That's the real challenge. And here you need to have a strategy, a technique how to learn that allows you to deal with this increased pace. So another topic that the university has absolutely to address is the how to learn, so that you are efficient in your learning processes as well.
Right, so that was Lino talking about this concept of talent, which we will be discussing in September at ETH Zurich. And Phil, would you like to start off by just commenting on what you thought was interesting about what he was talking about with concept and this perhaps idea of the universitas and the idea of the university environment that people should try to create?
Yeah, I think there's a real exciting element here because we all know that a university is nothing without its talent, and its job is also to nurture a generation of talent beyond the walls of the academy. And actually, we worked with Lino and ETH at the World Economic Forum in Davos for the last couple of years, and we're working with them this year and exploring these issues. And I think for me, one of the big issues is around, and as Lino was explaining, what universities actually have to deliver for their students. You know, we have the fourth industrial revolution. It's almost a cliche to say we're preparing them for jobs that don't exist yet, but there is a reality that we're preparing them for a very uncertain future, incredible rapid development in AI, and this notion that robots will take lots of jobs. We're preparing them for all jobs and any future jobs, not for specific jobs. Mm-hmm. I think it's vital that universities have a really close look at their curricula, what they actually teach, but also how they teach, how they instill a range of transferable, to use another cliche, the soft skills idea, but you're actually teaching them how to solve problems, you're teaching them how to be resilient, you're teaching them how to confront failure and learn from failure. You're not teaching them a bunch of narrow skills for their first career, you're teaching them for their lives and the need for lifelong learning. So there's some fantastically important issues around the student experience. But also with Zurich, talent is also about nurturing academic talent, giving young early career scholars the chance to thrive, giving them the space and time to actually create the big discoveries, understand the world and make the breakthroughs that are needed for fueling the economy and continuing the academic mission. So there's a whole range of fantastic things. Sorry to probably go on too long, but you've also got how you source and find talent. There's a huge issue about access. Do universities actually find and discover that the smartest young people? There's an issue about inclusivity and diversity of access. So there's a huge range of excellent subjects there, and I'm really excited about that one.
Yeah, I think that's going to be one of the big questions that comes up in Zurich, but equally at some of the other summits we've got before then about, how confident are the leaders that they're recruiting the right students, that they're recruiting genuinely the best and those with the most potential in their faculty as well. How much do they trust that their access initiatives are really working?
There's some huge issues around the world as well, around from the academic perspective, issues of bed blocking and nepotism. There are whole university systems where age trumps talent, so there's a whole issue around attracting undergraduate talent, getting the right people and letting them thrive as individuals, but within the academic system as well, meritocracy, genuine opportunities for people to realise their potential and not have to have, the elder statesman sitting in his chair for far too long being less productive. So really big questions about how we run and understand universities as well.
Yeah, that's true. And building on that, we'll be talking about place in Toronto, which I think is also another factor that's going to really impact on universities' ability to recruit from this global talent pool that we'll be discussing in Zurich. So let's go to Merrick first. And I started out by asking him the same thing that I asked Lino about this question of how talent has changed for this current generation of students.
I think current generations of students are facing a number of challenges and sources of uncertainty, and I think that they are very conscious of how the economy seems to be changing around them, with a lot of traditional industries either disappearing or being kind of fundamentally disrupted by technological and organizational changes, and that's creating a lot of anxiety for them.
Mm-hmm.
It is, I think, putting more pressure on them to become kind of ready for work, a sense that they need to have some practical skills and ideally some experience. So it's one of the things that's driving a growing interest in experiential learning, learning by doing while you are a student. So I think that's one of the things that's happening. In addition, I would say that there's a growing kind of conversation about the importance of so-called STEM disciplines and quantitative and other analytical skill sets that I think seem to be of growing importance in many different occupations and many different fields. So whether you're actually an engineer or you're a financial analyst or, you know, you're a policy analyst. So that's putting the spotlight, I think, on a certain set of skills around kind of analytics, around the ability to marshal effective arguments using both quantitative and qualitative forms of evidence. I think that's likely to grow in importance over time.
Mm.
I would also say, though, that the changes we see in the economy are inducing a lot of students to recognize the importance of acquiring the sorts of competencies that employers are telling us increasingly are important, things like problem-solving abilities and analytical capabilities more broadly, things like being able to communicate really well, both in written and in oral forms, things like, being creative, things like being very effective in working collaboratively with other team members, and also the kinds of interpersonal skills and emotional intelligence that enable you to work effectively not only with peers in a team, but with clients and others around you. So if you think about that skill set, it's pretty generic in a way.
Mm.
It's the kind of set of capabilities that will be useful in all kinds of different occupations and in all kinds of different sectors of the economy. For higher education institutions, I think the implication is that we need to ensure that our graduates leave our institutions not only with sector-specific knowledge in one or more disciplines, but also with really well-developed skill sets that address those core competencies. It's those kinds of things that are going to give our graduates the resilience that they will need to reinvent themselves continuously over time.
Mm.
The other big trend, of course, is that once they leave their full-time studies, whether undergraduate or postgraduate, learning won't stop then.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make sure that they're well set up to continue learning throughout their working lives, as they're likely to experience disruption in their own careers from time to time. We have to make sure that universities are places where they can come back and continue to learn and upgrade and retool.
Mm.
So that's really forcing us to rethink our role and expand our traditional role and have a bigger role to play in lifelong learning.
Yeah, it sounds like your notion of talent then, if we're going to kind of establish two dichotomies of types of talent here, either innate or developed, it sounds like you might be in the developed camp in terms of helping students develop this really 21st century skill set of an ever-changing
Absolutely.
Economy and being work ready.
Yeah, I firmly believe that. I think that our own experience in Toronto has been that you can really make a big difference in helping students develop these kinds of capabilities that might have been latent, need to be drawn out and accentuated and developed.
University of Toronto is the 2020 host for the World Academic Summit. And not so coincidentally, considering your background in economic geography, the theme for that summit is looking at place. And yeah. I'd like to hear your thoughts about how you think place really comes into play as technology is ever increasingly widening the traditional classroom and connecting people across the globe. How does this notion of place come into play in terms of the unique learning experiences that universities can offer students?
Well, place is, of course, I think an increasingly important concept. And, you know, we do face an interesting kind of paradox. On the one hand, information technology makes it so much easier for us to communicate with people across vast distances instantaneously. It also makes it so much easier for us to have access to information that previously would have taken us, you know, much more work and much more time to have access to. So it's tremendously horizon expanding on one real level. At the same time, you know, I think it, and here's where the paradox comes in, local relations and local opportunities are, in my view, becoming more important over time rather than less. So let me sort of unpack that idea a little bit more. You know, we, in the higher education field, we have spent a lot of time talking about online learning tools and, you know, things like MOOCs and other forms of online learning that are obviously mediated by or enhanced by technology. When these tools were first introduced, there were a lot of predictions about how they would put traditional bricks and mortar universities out of business and replace them with these sort of digital forms of learning. And while we've certainly seen a lot of growth of that kind of activity, you know, a couple of things have happened as these technologies have matured and as our thinking about how to grapple with them has developed. You know, the first thing is that we have recognized online learning tools as more of a complement to traditional face-to-face learning than a substitute for face-to-face learning. That we figured out ways in which digital technologies can enrich the in-person learning experience, you know, where we see these hybrid classrooms, for example, where students can master the sort of basic content of a lecture on their own time, times that are convenient to them, and then they come to class with an opportunity for richer interaction between a faculty member and the class itself, perhaps focused on problem solving, perhaps in groups and these kinds of things. We're building new kinds of classrooms that allow us to mix these forms of learning more effectively. You know, I think that the sort of bottom line is that sort of interpersonal interaction, which is facilitated by geographical proximity, remains a really important, in fact, an increasingly important form of learning.
Can I just ask you to elaborate a little bit on that last point that it's becoming, you said, almost more and more important now than, would you say, 20 years ago? And I'm wondering if you could expand on that a little bit more.
Sure. Well, you know, it's become more important because we're shifting from passive to active learning. We're shifting from the sage on the stage kind of model to one where that sage is now interacting much more with students, you know, in answering questions, in convening conversations, in setting up, you know, group problem solving opportunities in the classroom. With a lot of real-time interaction. And while it's not impossible to do that digitally, it works a lot better in face-to-face settings. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that is really important. I guess the other thing that has happened is that with the rise of online learning and these kinds of opportunities, universities have also recognized that in order to compete with those online models. They need to leverage the advantages of being there physically, you know, for a student being physically present at a university, in order to make sure that that more traditional form of learning actually outcompetes these digital forms. So, for example, students, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, are increasingly interested in learning by doing and having, you know, real experiential opportunities where they're working in the community, perhaps related to a course that they're taking, possibly through an internship or a co-op placement, and where these opportunities are on the doorsteps of universities and the communities around us. So, you know, universities like ours are being induced, I think, to make more of those opportunities available for our students. And in doing so, leverage the advantage of being situated in a community like Toronto to help benefit our students. Mm. So, you know, we're really connecting them to internships. We're connecting them to service learning opportunities in the community, where there's kind of a double payoff. Students learn so much from that experience, but they also are actually doing a lot of good things in the community with the partners that are working alongside them.
Mm.
So, you know, I guess the sort of upshot is that place is becoming more important as a source of learning opportunities for our students. And it was ironically the advent of online learning tools that I think has propelled a lot of universities like ours to recognize those local opportunities as being so important and so valuable.
And that was Merrick Gertler talking about place and how technology is actually making place and where universities are situated in their communities actually even more important, which I thought was quite surprising considering everyone speaking about how technology is increasingly connecting us globally. Phil, what did you think?
I think it is an extraordinary situation, isn't it, that you think about how connected we all are, and we look at the phenomenally good technology for video conferencing and remote learning and distance learning and MOOCs, and we keep talking about this huge revolution in connectivity through the digital world, and yet it does actually seem that place is becoming more and more important for higher education in particular, perhaps less so around the undergraduate experience, but that's still relevant. You know, there was some study recently about proximity to airports were actually really important in terms of a university's ranking performance. It is about being in a hub, being in a place where there's a critical mass of talent. So this idea that, you know, these big cities like New York and Toronto and of course Zurich, London, that it's this sense that actually it's all about rubbing up against one another. I think the former mayor of London, whose views on diversity seem to be significantly different to what they were when he was running London, he talked about London being this amazing sort of cyclotron of talent, this idea that's like a particle smasher of just great people in the same place, and that's great arts and humanities people, great cultural institutions, loads of brilliant universities rubbing up against outstanding tech companies and creating this critical mass. And I do think it's a real issue around how to ensure this fusion of excellence doesn't exclude more remote parts of the world, doesn't exclude regions that are more geographically isolated.
But you see, I think that that's exactly what we've just learned from, Phil and I have just been in Doha at our Emerging Economies Summit, and we had a keynote from Professor Sethanuram Panchanathan, who's the Executive Vice President for the Arizona State University and runs their Knowledge Enterprise Center there. And he actually said, we were talking about, you know, the incredible technologies and innovations that are coming out of ASU and in Phoenix, and how relevant can they be for the rest of the world? Or, you know, if it works in Phoenix, but is it going to work in the Philippines? You know, and he was saying that the reason that their innovation works is precisely because they're able to then work with a global network of other universities that have got that local context and that local understanding. So in a sense, you know, there's almost a risk of bringing in too much fantastic talent all into the ASU campus, because they need to ensure that there's still people who really understand how to deliver and implement and understand the cultural context of how innovation is going to be perceived and received.
Mm.
You know, even if you can create a piece of technology and put it at the appropriate price point so that it would work in Delhi, for example, you know, you still need to work with IIT Delhi to actually understand, you know, how you can get that to the market, how people will use it and work on it. You know, there's no point bringing over the best Indian scientists. You know, Panchanathan himself came from India as an undergraduate to the US and has, you know, settled and stayed and achieved amazing things. But he needs to work with Indians in India to create technology that is relevant to and can, you know, transform India itself.
It's that local knowledge that's still extremely valuable. He also had President Gertler had some interesting concepts around talent that were a bit different from Lino's. Tim, what did you think about those?
Well, I mean, I liked the idea that the phrase he used about universities is a place to learn, upgrade and retool graduates. You know, and it's that sense of there being really a place for, you know, once you in a sense, you never leave the University of Toronto. It can always be a place where people can come back and improve themselves for their fifth job rather than focusing on just their first job. You know, and that responsibility that universities have to ensure that they're creating people who've got, you know, skills for life. You know, clearly it came through very clearly, I think, from what he was saying, which is refreshing, actually.
It's interesting. We talk about the coherence between summits. We're all in Singapore in September 18, and one of the issues in Singapore is a really significant top-down push to promote lifelong learning.
Right.
I think NUS, National University of Singapore, is pioneering this in the sense that you literally don't graduate from NUS. Mm. They've sort of, I think they keep you actually a member of the student community for the 20 years after you complete your degree, which is a really novel new way of really putting it at the forefront. I think a lot of us don't really check back in with our universities, do we? No. But this is a way of really building that in formally.
But it's like, as Lino said, talking about, you know, helping people learn efficiency in their learning. And then, you know, with Gertler, as he's just said in that interview about, you know, setting up their graduates to learn post-study, you know, I suppose it's very much the notion that what you're teaching your undergraduate population is not enough.
Right.
Which is, you know, for a learning provider is quite a big shift, I suppose, in culture.
Yeah, you've got to keep honing your skills and upskilling and staying on top of it. And that was something that Andy Hamilton, president of NYU, also brought up, was just following students through their trajectory of life after their academic career and into a professional career. So I started out by asking him, same question, how has this concept of talent changed? And here's what he had to say. My first question for you then, President Hamilton, is talking about this notion of global talent and how that's perhaps changed for the current generation of students compared to the previous generations. Has it?
Yeah, I think... Sarah, it's constantly changing. Of course, it is by definition. The world changes, skills, challenges that students and perhaps most importantly graduates of universities face when they enter the world and the workplace changes from one generation, from one decade to the next. And so in that regard, I think we, by definition, universities, at least good ones, are constantly reinventing themselves. They are constantly changing their approach to education. They are constantly inventing fields or responding to new discoveries in science, in artificial intelligence, in medicine, in digital humanities. You know, you could list scores of areas that we have seen in the last years and decades that have become vital and dynamic parts of our activities. Another perfect example is the way in which universities in the 21st century have recognized diversity as a critical dimension of excellence, that we are not excellent without a diverse student body, without a diverse faculty, and the diversity of intellectual endeavor comes from the diversity of the community. And so for me, you know, talent is a vague word, but in many respects it's a word that it reflects the constant reinvention that universities participate in. But that being said, Sarah, obviously there are certain fundamental aspects of intellectual development that were the same under Aristotle as they are today, and the importance of critical analysis, the importance of self-expression, the importance of creative thinking. These are fundamental principles and foundations of an education that haven't changed in 2,000 years, let alone two decades. And so they too have to be part of the way we think about the development of talent in our students. That yes, we've got to prepare them for an ever-changing world, but we also must ensure that the fundamental principles of their education are sound, are strong, and actually will prepare them for the world that will change in ways we can't possibly predict. Mm-hmm. And I'll finish by saying, you know, one of the things I feel very strongly is that universities do have a responsibility to prepare our students for their first job, the first job they will get after graduation. But we have an equal responsibility to prepare them for their fifth job, which won't be for 20 or 25 years. That will be in a world, in an economy, in a technology that we can't possibly predict. And so the fundamental principles of education become ever more important in that regard.
Hmm. I'm glad you bring that up, because we're talking about the World Academic Summit series, and NYU is going to host the 2021 World Academic Summit. And you've chosen trajectory as to be the theme upon which the discussions will be based. And one question I did want to ask you is how universities should prepare students for the trajectory of their academic and professional lives. And I think you've kind of touched on it there. So I'm going to ask you my follow-up question, which was, what does that support and preparation look like for this diverse cohort of students that are entering higher education now, especially in the United States, if we're looking at non-traditional learners, as some people are calling them?
Yeah, Sarah, that's in a sense, I think I've tried to answer that in the sense that in whatever field the students enter, we have got to prepare them for the field, their field of study, their career pathways. We've got to prepare them for those so that they are relevant, so that they are up to date, they are properly skilled to take their place in that career pathway. So the up to date character of that education is critical. But where else does that extend? It extends into the preparation for students to take their place in a diverse population, in a diverse community within their workplace, and in the cities, the towns, the countries that they live in. You know, it also involves preparing them to be part of a global economy. And of course, no university has committed more to ensuring that its students are ready for the global workplace than NYU, with our 14 sites around the world. And for me, all of those are issues that are critical, that our students are up to date. But then I reinforce that with the continued emphasis on those core principles of learning, like critical thinking, like creative thinking.
I'd also like to ask you about the trajectory of an institution, and how much of that journey is dictated by a core strategy that you set out, and how much of it is perhaps influenced by unforeseen societal, cultural, and political events.
Yeah. That's a great question, and obviously, you know, let me just say that word trajectory, one of the things that appealed to us is that it can apply to an individual, a person, that's the trajectory of a student through freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior, the trajectory of a graduate throughout their career and their life, and the role of lifelong learning in their trajectory, but as you have raised, the trajectory of an institution, and I mentioned at the beginning the trajectory that NYU has been on in the last few decades has been quite remarkable. Your comment is very valid. How much of that should be determined by a core strategy? I would argue the sizable majority of it, the core principles and values that underpin an institution, the strategic planning process that every university of note goes through, the way it responds to what it sees as the key direction for its future, that should be carefully thought through. That should be consultative. It should be the input of many in the community, faculty, students, staff, alumni have important contributions to make, as well as the community in which the university might find itself. So for me, the very, very significant impulse, imperative, has to be the core strategic mission and priorities that the institution sets for itself. But of course, those must be reviewed, and they must be reviewed every 5 years, every 10 years, in very serious ways. And the review, of course, not only takes account of progress that's been made, not only takes account of adjustments to the direction that need to occur, but also of changing forces in the world at that time, whether they be demographic forces, whether they be cultural forces or political forces. And so, you know, I am quite sure that British universities right now are responding to the prospect of Brexit in ways that 2 to 3 years ago they weren't even considering, because of the necessity that the reinforcement of international collaboration become more central and more critical in their planning. And so, you know, in that regard, the periodic assessment of the strategic plan of any university to the changing political, cultural, and demographic factors has to be in any institution's broad discussion. That being said, to me, one of the fundamental roles of universities are to be rocks within society, and I mean that from a stability rather than a shipwreck perspective. No, they are rocks. Political winds come and go. Political governments come and go. NYU is a university that's been in existence for 187 years. Oxford has been in existence for more than 850 years. And so they are not institutions that should be overly reactive to political changes, but periodically assess the degree to which strategic plans and priorities need to be adjusted because of those changing factors that I discussed earlier.
Hmm. And your role specifically as a leader, we've been discussing this a little bit over in the UK, just in terms of the universities, how they're what cards they're playing in the Brexit debate. And I know that you recently wrote an op-ed and for the Washington Post talking about gun control and mass shootings and the role that university research can play in this epidemic really that's happening in the United States. So I'd like to hear your thoughts, just what role leaders should play whenever you're responding to those societal, cultural...
I think perhaps the single most important role, there are many roles that leaders with their academic communities in the broad discussions that take place in every university, but our job in the face of changing political winds is to ensure that universities remain focused on their core mission And that core mission is the creation of knowledge, the dissemination of knowledge, and the preservation of knowledge.
And that was Andy Hamilton talking about talent and then eventually trajectory and the university's trajectory. And one thing that I thought was quite interesting that Andy brought up that Lino and Merrick didn't necessarily touch on whenever they were speaking to me was the concept of diversity and how diversity was really important when looking at talent.
Yeah, I mean, I also thought that listening to the interviews and I guess, you know, it's partly informed by being in probably the most diverse city in the whole world. I mean, it's definitely a massive issue that, as Andy said, you know, students are going to have to be aware of. I think wherever they go back to post their NYU career, and as Andy said, the fact that NYU have got their, you know, more than a dozen campuses around the world really, really informs an NYU student. So you've got that opportunity that perhaps you wouldn't otherwise studying in Oxford, for example, where he used to be the vice chancellor.
And he also talked about how there's a constant reinvention that universities are in the process of doing, and talent as well is part of that, a constant reinvention of yourself and as students as they're going along their journey academically and professionally.
I think I really liked what he was saying about universities being rocks. If you think about the American context now, you do have a sense of complete crisis. You know, you've got a president who is effectively regularly denigrating evidence and facts, you know, very willfully misquoting climate science, with the climate scientists from MIT categorically stating he's misrepresented their work. You know, he's very much driving the post-truth world. And then you've got this huge anti-immigration sentiment going on in the US as well as very other parts of the world. So this idea that universities probably feel in a bit of a crisis at the moment, you know, in terms of funding, in terms of public perception. And it's true, you know, he ran Oxford, it's nearly 900 years old, NYU's over a century old, and they will always remain and they'll stay steadfast and they'll deliver this core, this fundamentally important service to the world. But despite that, they can't just be like they were 900 years ago or 100 years ago. They have to constantly rethink how they actually fulfill their missions, fulfill their roles, because there are constant existential threats to them and challenges to them. But, you know, fundamentally, they still do the same thing they did centuries ago, which is pursue truth and seek new knowledge. And I love that sentiment that, you know, they are robust enough to survive, but they also need tactics and techniques to weather the storms that are coming and hitting them in the shorter term.
Well, I think that's a good point to end on then, Phil. Thanks for that. And thanks for joining me, Tim.
Pleasure. Thank
you. Thanks for coming in, Phil. You can find out loads more information about our summit series and the World Academic Summits that are coming up over the next 3 years on timeshighereducation.com. Thanks for listening. If you've got any comments or questions, do get in touch, sarah.custer@timeshighereducation.com. We'll see you next time.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.